From the state capitol, WFSU Public Media brings you Capitol Report.
In Florida, the battle lines are being drawn in the upcoming fight over who will pay for all the infrastructure the AI industry needs.
I mean, ultimately, we got to care about the well-being of our people, not worried about the profits of the Magnificent Seven. They're doing just fine.
Also this week, we'll get a look ahead to how Florida property taxes may change now that Governor DeSantis has weighed in on the matter.
He's recommending hundreds of millions of dollars, actually, $300 million in non-recurring funds to cover potential loss of revenue in the property tax of various rural counties.
We'll also look at the simmering dispute between developers and those who want to keep rural lands undeveloped, and we'll explore the therapeutic power of music. I'm Tom Flanagan. Online and on air, this is Capitol Report and our weekly wrap-up of top stories from Tallahassee. Artificial intelligence is working its way into what feels like every part of online life. Its growth has piqued the interest of Florida policymakers and politicians ahead of the upcoming 2026 legislative session. But as Tristan Wood reports, the state may be on a collision course with the federal government.
Despite President Donald Trump saying he intends to release an executive order blocking state-level AI regulation, Governor Ron DeSantis is moving forward with his push for a so-called AI Bill of Rights.
We want to approach this in the state of Florida in a very intelligent way, but in a way that's putting Floridians first. I mean, ultimately, we got to care about the well-being of our people, not worried about the profits of the Magnificent Seven. They're doing just fine, and they will do just fine, but we've got to make sure that our folks are doing well.
The governor's proposal is broad, including prohibiting AI from using an individual's name, image, or likeness without their consent, stopping entities from providing therapy or mental health counseling through artificial intelligence, and providing parental controls for minors that would let parents access conversations their children have on AI platforms. Members of the Florida legislature have also backed the idea that the state should maintain some control over AI regulation. Senate President Ben Albritton said as much during a recent press availability.
We can figure out a way to land the plane, and we can make sure that Floridians have the protections that they deserve. AI is here. It's not going away. We're going to have to adapt what we're doing, and even state government, to make sure that it's being used the right way for the right reasons.
Another topic policymakers have focused on is the data centers that do AI's computing. Florida isn't a hotbed for where those large data centers are being built currently, but some lawmakers expect more such construction to come to the state. Margaret Barthel, a public media reporter with WAMU in Northern Virginia, says her region has seen a spike in their development.
The suburbs outside of D.C. are basically the sort of birthplace of what we now know as the internet. And as a result, they had really advanced fiber infrastructure really quickly. And that obviously, that is one of the things that attracts data centers to an area. They also want to be close to major population centers because that cuts down on something called latency, which is like the time that it takes for the data center to process your request for.
That infrastructure plus tax incentives helped grow data centers into a $9.1 billion annual industry in Virginia. It's also led to some groups to push back against more center construction there, citing concerns ranging from increasing utility prices for everyone else to having negative environmental contamination impacts. DeSantis has included some of those concerns in his proposed AI Bill of Rights. For example, it would prohibit government subsidies for the centers and would allow local governments to block their construction.
Our point of view is, you know, you should not have to pay one dime more in utility costs, water, power, any of this stuff, because of this. These are some of the most wealthy companies in the history of humanity. They should not be able to offload costs onto people that are already strapped with high costs in other areas.
But many in Florida are preparing for data centers to come to the state. Tiffany Cohen with Florida Power and Light said during a Florida House committee meeting about AI that state regulators recently approved a tariff that would allow FPL to charge high-energy users, like the data centers, upfront for their upgraded power needs and infrastructure, instead of charging other ratepayers.
These tariffs are structured to provide a clear, predictable path for connecting major new loads to the grid. They outline the costs, the requirements, and the commitments upfront, giving data center operators the certainty they need to make long-term investments, and at the same time, they protect existing customers.
And Christopher Mayer, who is overseeing a team selecting data center locations for Cielo Digital Infrastructure, told lawmakers he thinks the state is well positioned to bring in data center projects.
It was always a misperception about hurricanes and the impact of storms in Florida. I think we've done a really good job of positioning ourselves to overcome that, as you all are aware. Our utilities have done a tremendous job in hardening the grid.
What direction the Florida legislature takes with DeSantis' AI Bill of Rights proposal is still unclear. No comprehensive package has been filed yet, but some policy about AI will likely be filed before the legislative session officially kicks off. I'm Tristan Wood.
As we swing towards the year-end vacation and holiday time, tis the season, as they say, to check in with WUSF's man at the Capitol, Douglas Soule, and happy holidays to you, Douglas, and I hope you have some wonderful plans for the holidays.
Happy holidays. I do. I'm visiting my family back up in West Virginia, then rushing back down here for the new year. What about yourself?
I would love to get back to that part of the world. In fact, I was thinking of you the other day. I just saw all the ice that is in the Blackwater Canyon down in the southern part of West Virginia. And I thought, boy, that looks like something that Douglas would be having a hankering to revisit at this point.
I'm a Florida man now. That ice sends shivers down my spine, as it would if I were in person, because it's cold. But yeah, I'm looking forward to getting back to some colder weather.
Well, boy, hey, that's an appropriate segue. Shivers down the spine, because a lot of local governments here in Florida, the cities and the counties, they are also having shivery spines right now with the prospect of perhaps losing property tax revenue, depending on what happens during the 2026 Florida lawmaking session. So with our holiday greetings disposed of, let's get right into it. We had a bunch of different plans that lawmakers were considering as we head into the holidays here, Douglas. How many plans remain viable, and are there any that are in the lead or some that may be yet to fall by the wayside? Where are we here?
Well, we're seeing a flurry of them moving through the committee process on the House side. It seems like the House is relatively intent on preparing it for the House floor when the session starts in mid-January. The big question mark isn't about that. It's about what the Senate wants to do. You said yourself that local governments are shivering a little bit at the prospect of reducing property tax revenue, which funds all sorts of critical services at the local level. Well, Senate President Ben Albritton seems to be very wary of that himself. He indicates he agrees with some degree of reduction or way to address the property tax, but his chamber hasn't pitched anything yet. He's a small town guy, a rural guy, and it's the small towns and the rural counties in Florida that will be hit the hardest if cuts are made. And he seems to be very aware of that. So big question marks right now as to how and if the Senate and the House are going to agree on what to do.
Well, if the House is still pretty enthusiastic, at least about the basic prospect of property tax reduction and or elimination, and the Senate is being a little bit more circumspect about it, we also know that Governor Ron DeSantis is still very much in the let's just get rid of it side of the equation. That remains too, right?
An update with DeSantis. Starting off, it seemed like he started talking about cutting the property tax. It seemed he just wanted it gone, gone, gone. He since targeted most of his attention toward the property tax on primary residences, not necessarily like Airbnbs or commercial properties. That being said, we haven't seen a specific proposal from his team, but we did see something with his proposed budget. He's recommending hundreds of millions of dollars, actually, $300 million in non-recurring funds to cover potential loss of revenue in the property tax of various rural counties. So he, in his mind, is expecting something to pass, it appears, and he's also expecting rural counties to potentially be hit harder than others by this.
Given all of this difference in approach, then, it would seem as though we have a long ways to go to come up with any kind of accommodation twixt the House and the Senate and the governor's office to pull in some kind of cohesive constitutional amendment proposal that could go before voters in the 2026 election. So will this be just a protracted discussion during the entirety of session, or at the beginning or the end? What do you think is going to happen, Douglas?
You know, it's really hard to anticipate. Things in the legislature go slowly than happen all at once in many occasions. I would expect to see the House to continue to push this really hard. Senate President Ben Albritton is emphasizing they're still measuring. We don't know how long that measuring is going to take. Senate President Ben Albritton has this philosophy of measuring three times and cutting once. I don't know if they're on the first or second or third measurement, but all eyes in the Capitol are on that. And of course, there's always also the redistricting topic, which is a completely different bundle of interesting things to watch.
Boy, do we have a lot of fun stuff to talk about as we head into a bright and shiny new year and a legislature in Tallahassee that kicks things off on January 13th. So we will be checking back with you on a very regular basis for all these kinds of things. Douglas Soule from WUSF, happy holidays to you, good sir, and we will see you on the flip, as they say.
I look forward to it. You have a good one.
Coming up on Capitol Report, the present wave of anti-Semitic violence has Jewish congregations on high alert.
I think all Jewish institutions at this point are going to be having ramped up security measures.
An investigative report by the Miami Herald and Tampa Bay Times suggests the DeSantis administration diverted more than $35 million in taxpayer money to fight two ballot initiatives, money that should have gone somewhere else.
So it was allocated mostly from healthcare funds and also for child welfare funds for children who needed protection in the foster care system.
It's the old city versus country debate, but with untold millions of dollars worth of development hanging in the balance, politics is playing an even bigger role.
Why is a Lee County state senator going out there and meddling with us in Seminole County?
Florida's official public health policy is moving away from required vaccinations, but that hasn't stopped many in the medical community from citing worrisome data.
Just in the past 6 months, we've had two patients in the ICU with HIP. One child unfortunately succumbed at 4 months of age, no vaccines.
Florida signs on to a multi-state lawsuit against the popular weed killer Roundup.
There have been a lot of trials in Missouri, California, Pennsylvania, Georgia State Court.
And the old saying about music having charms to soothe the savage beast is being amended to say music has charms to soothe the saddened soul.
We can work in early intervention, and we can work in developmental and special education areas, and we can work in medical areas.
Local Jewish leaders are mourning the massacre of at least 15 people on an Australian beach during the first day of Hanukkah. WUSF Steve Newborn talked with the head of the Florida Holocaust Museum in St. Petersburg about the repercussions.
The killings happened after a wave of anti-Semitic attacks in Australia over the past year. Those dead include a 10-year-old girl, a rabbi, and a Holocaust survivor. The Holocaust Museum's CEO, Eric Stillman, says shootings like this have become all too familiar and all too sad.
I think all Jewish institutions at this point are going to be having ramped up security measures. And while they may not publicize what those are, I believe all the institutions are taking those measures because this is unfortunately all too familiar a refrain. This is just a punch in the gut.
Stillman says if we fail to educate people about the impact of hateful rhetoric towards people who are different, these killings will continue to happen. I am Steve Newborn in Tampa.
An investigation by the Tampa Bay Times and Miami Herald has found that the DeSantis administration diverted an amount far greater than what had been previously reported in taxpayer money to fight two ballot initiatives last year. Amendments 3 and 4 would have allowed recreational use of marijuana and overturned the state's 6-week abortion ban. Florida Matters Live and Local host Sky LeBron spoke with reporters Justin Garcia and Alexandra Glorioso about what they learned.
In our latest story, we discovered that the DeSantis administration spending on Amendments 3 and 4 went beyond the $10 million that was diverted from the Medicaid settlement last year and included $21.2 million of state agency spending through an intricate web of financial transactions.
Justin, what was this taxpayer money initially allocated for? And can you tell me a little bit about where it ended up?
Yeah, so it was allocated mostly from healthcare funds and also for child welfare funds for children who needed protection in the foster care system. And most of it ended up going to ads, consultants, and the overall campaigns against Amendments 3 and 4 last year.
Can you tell me a little bit about how is this money supposed to help children? How is this money supposed to help people that were dealing with addiction?
Regarding child welfare, they diverted $1.1 million from a federal grant trust fund, and it's essentially supposed to help children stay in their homes, stay with their families, stay with their parents. And most of the money in that fund goes to organizations that do just that. They help kids stay with their parents. They provide counseling and other programs that parents need in order to safely keep their kids at home. Regarding the other money that we found that $970,000 came from a community health program in the Department of Health. And this was from a grants and AIDS trust fund and other programs that were supposed to be funded from the fund include $185,000 for a clinic to help children learn to feed and swallow, $500,000 on a Tampa Bay program aimed at reducing emergency room visits. We're not saying that they paid for the campaign from that money that was supposed to go to those two programs, but it shows the administration's priorities. Lawmakers wanted to fund those programs from the same grants and aids fund in the community public health program, but the governor vetoed those programs and also paid a vendor for the campaign out of that fund.
So, Justin, is this story as cut and dry as maybe it suggests? Would this be a clear violation of state law in that case?
Well, the experts we talked to and the lawmakers we spoke with were kind of mixed on that. The governor and the administration do have discretion on how they spend state funds, but several people saw it as bending procurement laws and also as kind of just morally and ethically bankrupt. And as far as like the total amount of money goes, we make a note towards the end of the story that this is likely an undercount of the total amount that was spent. We were kind of conservative in our estimation because we didn't include contracts that looked like they could have gone to the campaign. And so the amount we estimated could be less than what the state actually spent in total.
So with the $35 million that was allocated, ultimately used for campaigns against Amendment 3 and 4, for the departments that the money was taken out of, does that mean they were losing out? Did they have to cut certain things? Ultimately, did it hurt these departments in a real way?
To be clear, we haven't got any kind of official response from any of these agencies. As Alex broke down, it did take funds that could have gone to these services for needy Floridians, including children. But we reached out several times to these agencies and they didn't respond. Although after we've published the story, there have been some communications people from these agencies just kind of defending the behavior, not denying it at all, but defending it.
That was Florida Matters Live and Local host Sky LeBron speaking with reporters Justin Garcia and Alexandra Glorioso. Florida leaders are challenging rural boundaries within counties. WUSF's Jessica Mazaros reports Florida's attorney general says the local restrictions on development are likely unconstitutional.
Voters in Seminole County approved a rural boundary in 2004, and they reaffirmed it last year at a margin of 74%. David Baer is an attorney and president of the nonprofit Save Rural Seminole. He knows the history in his county.
Developers have long hated this idea of a rural boundary because it
pushes back on them.
As a longtime resident, Bear says folks in Seminole want to limit overdevelopment in rural areas. But Republican State Senator Jonathan Martin of Fort Myers doesn't agree. He sent a letter to the state's attorney general asking about the legality of rural classifications in Seminole and Orange counties, over 200 miles away from the area he represents. We reached out to Martin, but he hasn't answered. Bear questioned his motives.
Why is a Lee County state senator going out there and meddling with us in Seminole County?
The attorney general's response to Martin's letter says the property restrictions on rural landowners may go too far under federal and state constitutions. Bear says he has no doubt these boundaries are legal under both.
What I do have doubt about is whether politicians can convince legislators in Tallahassee to preempt what our citizens and our local officials have done.
The attorney general's letter doesn't take action, but Bear fears this could pave the way for preemptive legislation down the line. I'm Jessica Mazaros in Tampa.
Florida's Surgeon General wants to end four-school vaccine mandates in the name of medical freedom. As WUSF's Kerry Sheridan reports, one vaccine that could become optional prevents a dangerous form of meningitis.
It's called Haemophilus influenza type B, or HIB. It's caused by a bacteria spread by coughing or sneezing. Dr. Paul Robinson is a pediatrician in Tallahassee who's been treating children for more than 40 years.
HIB didn't cause mild illness. It caused children to die.
He spoke at a Florida Department of Health workshop where state leaders are considering making the vaccine optional. Robinson says early in his career, as many as 20% of children he treated with HIB died from sepsis or severe infections of the brain and spinal cord.
And many survivors were left with deafness, paralysis, or lifelong neurologic injury.
A vaccine was introduced in the late 1980s, and since then, HIB has become rare. But vaccine rates are declining, and the disease is already resurfacing, says Ihab Kanawi, a pediatrician in Panama City.
Just in the past 6 months, we've had two patients in the ICU with HIB. One child unfortunately succumbed at 4 months of age, no vaccines. 1 month ago, I was on call, and another patient also came into the ICU. 2.5-year-old, never vaccinated, HIB, again, abscesses in the brain, seizures, brain dead, quote unquote, mother's words, please give my child every vaccine you can.
Many doctors spoke at the workshop urging the state not to change rules that require vaccines against HIB and three other diseases for daycares and schools. I'm Kerry Sheridan in Sarasota.
Florida will hold its first trial early next year over claims against the weed killer Roundup. Jessica Mazaros returns to speak with a man in Fort Lauderdale who says long-term exposure led to his cancer diagnosis.
A Broward County judge ruled that federal law does not preempt the claims brought by 37-year-old Alexander Palacios, who was diagnosed with non-Hodgkin's lymphoma at 34. That ruling drops the state in the center of a national legal clash over whether federal pesticide law shields the Bayer company from state laws that protect consumers. Daniel DiMatteo is an attorney representing Palacios.
There have been a lot of trials in Missouri, in California, Pennsylvania, Georgia State Court, New Mexico, but it's the first of its kind in Florida.
He says his client had no known risk factors other than years of Roundup exposure as a landscaper.
What that justice ultimately looks like will be in the hands of a jury of Alex's peers who are going to hear about the turmoil that this has brought to his life, the stress, anxiety, and pain that he has to live with, his rumination about the future, his fear of leaving his young boy fatherless.
The case is set for trial in Fort Lauderdale on March 9th. I'm Jessica Mazaros in Tampa.
You're listening to Capital Report from WFSU Public Media. I'm Tom Flanagan. Finally this week, sound is all around us, and some of it can be healing. Floridians are turning to music therapy clinics to rebuild memory, mobility, and even hope. Central Florida Public Media's Ava Jessam tells us how licensed therapists use everyday instruments to treat a wide range of patients.
So you started on G?
It's a quiet Tuesday morning when 32-year-old Michael Morrison arrives for his weekly session at Joyful Music Therapy. After suffering a traumatic head injury at age 11, Michael has been coming to music therapy for the last 7 years.
I was just doing my own thing with music to help my own problems of anger and resentment in my life, and then I started later on writing songs on paper.
Within his sessions, Michael is working with clinic founder Tamala Ponder to create an album dedicated to his uncle who recently died. For Michael, it's been a necessary outlet to process the stages of grief.
It's the first time that somebody close to him has passed. Helping him to write a song and then him asking his mom if he could play it at the funeral, and then he brought me a video of him playing it and singing it, that is something really special.
Every session looks different and can vary from learning to play an instrument to listening to music or even writing songs as a form of expression. And as music therapy continues to provide personalized care for unique needs, it's growing in popularity here in Florida.
The conservative estimate is that 15,500 Floridians receive music therapy services each week. And then the largest population of people that we serve at a 61% is autism spectrum disorder. And then right underneath that is behavioral disorder.
Despite music therapy's uptick in popularity, it's difficult to fund, shares Dr. Kimberly Senamore, an associate professor of music therapy at Florida Gulf Coast University.
One of the things that makes us hard to define, because we can work in early intervention, and we can work in developmental and special education areas, and we can work in medical areas, and end-of-life care, and everything in between.
But it comes at a cost. One way many families in Central Florida have traditionally received coverage is through Sunshine Health Medicaid. But recently, changes to Medicaid certifications have forced organizations to cancel sessions without notice.
There can be policy changes, and that's one of the things we're experiencing right now in the state of Florida, is a shift of the organization the state has hired to manage these funds that has its own transitional challenges.
Joyful Music Therapy is working to make sessions affordable despite the funding challenges, even offering discounted sessions. One person who's still finding care despite these challenges is Dolly Villafana, who has been driving her grandson Matthew to music therapy every Tuesday for over a decade. Matthew is a 14-year-old with Dravet syndrome, an epileptic disorder with no cure.
Music has made change in his life. So we started here, can't remember who referred my daughter Monica to Joyful Therapy, but it changed his life.
Matthew's sessions at Joyful Music Therapy have helped him retain important motor skills. Doctors said he would be in a wheelchair by age 10, but 4 years later, Matthew continues to walk on his own. For Dolly, it's been a game changer for her family, and she wants others to have that same experience.
We drive like 45 minutes. I don't care. If I would have to drive 1.5 hours, I would, because it's so important and it has made so many changes in Matthew's life. So I would definitely say, give it a try.
I'm Ava Jessam.
Our regular Capitol Report correspondents are Gina Jordan, Regan McCarthy, and Tristan Wood. Thanks also to Douglas Soule, Steve Newborn, Sky LeBron, Carrie Sheridan, Jessica Mazzaros, and Ava Jessam. Technical support for Capitol Report comes from Evan Rossi, and I'm Tom Flanagan. May your end-of-year holidays be merry, bright, and free of unwanted drama. We invite you to join us again next week online and on air for more reports from the state capitol.
Capitol Report is a production of WFSU Public Media in Tallahassee.